Birth, the Grand Division, Chapter 16. Boris arrived early to work and noticed a few extra cars in the parking area. As he neared the secure employee entrance, there was a commotion and some camera lights turned on. He walked forward, experienced with reporters trying to dig for information about the Energy Bureau. He could handle these amateurs. "Mr. Domashev, can you answer some questions?" came the first shout. "Can you tell us about how you attacked an innocent Muslim man out with his friends?" came another. "Did you know he was going to sue?" he shouted as Boris locked his face in stone and walked through the din of ignorance to the door, where his pass card would admit only him. It amazed him how only a few hours passed, and they knew he was a FedEx driver, and his name, and probably knew his route as well as him by now. "Boris, the station manager wants to see you," said the sorting manager, who was about to check out after a long night of packing trucks with packages that arrived from the midnight flight and trucks that arrived early that morning from other cities. He used to work for this man before he worked his way up to driver. His reputation for reliability and endurance and attention to detail was spotless. And now all of that virtue might end through one act of self-defense. Like the day the Energy Bureau was dissolved and his early lifetime of achievement with the Soviet Union was swept out the door like so much dust, he felt wounded and sick inside. "Don't worry, Boris," his beautiful Sasha told him. "A closing door loosens a window. We will survive." They did survive. And Boris built another career and worked for 25 years more to build it to a decent living for them in Almaty, Kazakhstan. But the war of attrition followed him here. House by house, street by street, they were invading and taking over the peaceful town of Almaty. The evil force they abhorred for centuries, society was now tolerating and would soon swallow their community in its deadly embrace. "You wanted to see me?" said Boris with a tone of superiority. "Yes, Boris. Come in, please, and close the door," said the station manager with a slight smile. He wanted to make Boris disarm himself. There was no counseling or reasoning with a man who was conditioned to take the slings and arrows of Soviet lawyers and auditors once he put on his game face. "We have some bothersome company outside, eh?" "So it would seem, sir," he said, not falling for his familiar tone. "You don't need to tell me what happened," he said, walking around to his chair. "My sister was there, at the Tinkoff, when you tossed that piece of shit into the glass." His tone was not so common now. "I lost a brother in Afghanistan, and I have a nephew that is stationed in Syria right now. I know you better than you think, comrade," he said with the quiet rumble one learns working in the smelly bowels of the former Soviet juggernaut. "Well, I'm ready to drive my route. How long do you think the battery lights will last on those cameras out there?" asked Boris, experienced with the news cycle in modern Kazakhstan. "I got a call from my boss last night. He said to stand by you, but the Muslims will want some blood." "I'm happy to spill some more," said Boris coldly. "I don't think that's what they have in mind," said the manager as he parted the blinds slightly to see if they were still out there. "Some lashes, then?" "The legal point of fact is that you were not on the job at the time. The company should do nothing, in my opinion. But we are part of the community, and we must maintain an image. You understand," he said, and as a statement that was meant as a question. "What don't I know about image? You should have got my job, comrade. But let us reason together," he began laughing slightly. "Go home, Boris, and come back tonight on the midnight sorting line for a week or two. We take your Russian face off the street for a couple of weeks and let the company send some letters of apology. Then we get your ass back in the seat. I won't even cut your pay. Because I think you should have killed the son of a bitch, okay?" Boris stood up. "My Sasha thanks you, comrade. She is still shaking this morning as I left her in my warm bed. I will see you at midnight." He extended his hand and gripped the manager's hand with the same strength. And you? Asked the manager. I am grateful. Of course, I'm angry that I'm being reprimanded so severely, but I am grateful, said Boris with the first hint of a smile above his chin. They released their grip, and Boris took out his phone to call a cab. I insist, said the manager, holding up his hand to stop him. Let me take you home. Mind if I get a coffee? Asked Boris. Let's both get one, he said. I need to drive your route in an hour. They both laughed quietly, changed the looks on their faces, and walked out the door. They poured some coffee, and the manager informed the dispatcher that Boris's route would be turned over to him for a couple of weeks. They walked out into the crisp pre-dawn morning on the opposite side of the building that the reporters were allowed to stand, and got into the manager's Jeep Wagoneer. It's the poor man's BMW, he said, cranking the motor to a 10-year-old rumble. Kazakh roads were hard on a car, and four-wheel drive was a necessity to make sure you were never late to work. They pulled away from the airport annex and turned up the two-lane highway toward town a few miles away. This was one of the better roads built with tax money, levied against the mines and oil fields that helped pull the country out of the recession after it was cut loose from the Soviet Union. There was no revolution. There was no rioting. People were happy to be free, but felt a little like a wild animal who had been raised in captivity. They realized very quickly no one was coming to fill the banks with money. So they went to work. With the strong German work ethic that made them a mainstay for their rulers of nearly a century, they went to Wall Street, raised money, and began to build their economy. Not every state was so lucky. The Ukraine had natural resources as well, but without their own warm water ports, they relied on Europe to let them open the borders. After 25 years, they were faced with stiff tariffs everywhere they turn, except for Russia. The Crimeans voted to be annexed to Russia, but the Ukrainians defied that action. The coals of the World War still smoldered, and for a few years there were skirmishes and violence between them still. They turned off the airport road and headed into the older section of town where Boris lived. They stopped at a light and waited for a few moments. I can't wait for summer, said the manager. I want to take my boys camping. Suddenly, they felt a rumble in the ground that lasted for a few seconds. They looked at each other, and Boris leaned forward to look up into the sky for a jet or something. Earthquake? Asked the manager. We have had a few lately. Very unusual. They last longer than that, too, said Boris, leaning back in his seat. The light was long at this intersection, and they waited for the turn lane to change green. There were no road sensors for the lights in this city. That was more money. So no matter what traffic was doing, and right now there was very little traffic, the light for the cross traffic turned red, and the green turn light turned on. The manager took his foot off the brake and let out the clutch to pull through the intersection. Stop, urged Boris. He pointed to his right. There were sirens and lights coming down the crossroad from the fire station. Two trucks and a rescue van screamed by. Okay, I think it's clear. Maybe a boiler let go somewhere. I remember one time. Sasha, said Boris suddenly. Go fast, please, he said, waving his hand to the left. Okay, let's go, said the manager, shifting through the gears and following the trucks. They could be seen about a half mile up now, applying the brakes and turning toward the central part of town. The Jeep bounced around its worn shocks as they reached the end of the local road improvements. Within a couple of minutes, they arrived at the cross street where the trucks had turned right. There was no doubt now. They could see the dark smoke over the hill. Something was on fire. The light turned red, and they stopped, waiting for the slight traffic that was going slowly now, to watch the billowing smoke rise into the slightly lighting morning sky. Run it, said Boris loudly. Wait, there's an opening. Okay, I'm going. The manager stabbed the throttle and shifted quickly. He drove up to a line of cars that had been stopped ahead of them. Boris opened the passenger door and threw off his seatbelt. He began running down the street past the cars that were sitting in the long line to the top of the slight hill. Chilled fog rose slowly from their exhaust pipes without a care in the world as Boris breathed deeply and felt his leg muscles burning. The air was cold in his lungs and was cold on his bare hands that he pumped against that hill to get to his street. He had hope in his mind because it looked like the smoke was coming from the right side of the street, and his little duplex was on the left. The smoke began turning white, and he knew the fire trucks were pouring water on the flames now. He could smell the burning wood. His body wanted him to walk, but fear drove him on. He could feel himself slowing down, but he urged his stone body onward, and the air he was sucking into his lungs seemed like it carried no oxygen for his screaming legs. He broke his run and began fast walking, and he pulled hard on his chest as though he was breathing through a drinking straw. Hobbling now, half running, half walking, drowning in a gray haze that dulled his vision and ached in his chest, he reached the top of the slight hill. The smoke was coming from the left side of the intersection. Tears began to mix with the sweat coming down his face, and his vision was blurred by the steam rising off his cheeks. He unzipped his FedEx jacket, and a moan came out of his soul with each exhale. It was hoarse and exhausted and dry like the icy wind across the lake in the dead of the long Kazakh winter. He was only 3 blocks away now, and there was a crowd in the narrow street. There were police now, and he could see a solid traffic jam from all directions. Approaching the dense mob of neighbors and curiosity seekers and police, he pushed his way through. He felt like he was still running, but his mind realized he was barely swimming through the dense jam of people and cars and hoses and smoke. When he turned the corner to follow the hoses, his heart burst into tears, and the moan became so loud that it turned the faces of the people toward him. They began parting and making a path for him. He felt someone grab at his shoulder, but he pushed it away and kept trudging, tripping over bricks and boards and pieces of his life scattered over the street. Then a strong hand grabbed him from the side. "Boris," the unseen person yelled, "Mr. Domashev, stop, you cannot go any further." And he could not move, but he strained harder, arms wrapped around him now as the clouds of smoke and steam and police fell on him. The entire place was opened like a cabbage. The roof and walls of the second floor were gone, and the garage had collapsed on the car inside. Jets of water were pouring into the rubble. His neighbor's flat was obliterated as well. His life, his Sasha, was gone. "Mr. Domashev," said a man's voice. He turned toward it. "Where is she? What happened?" he asked through his pain. "Mr. Domashev, I am Detective Lair," said the voice. "I can tell you what happened if you will come with me." "Is she..." "I was..." he began to shake. "Hey, get some medical over here. I need some help here," yelled the detective. Within seconds, the paramedics were putting an oxygen mask over Boris's face and seating him on the rear bumper of the rescue van. "I was at work. I was coming home. I was coming home," he said as he swallowed the oxygen in and fogged the inside of the mask in an attempt to keep everything from going black. "Mr. Domashev, it was a car bomb. Witnesses said it parked out front and 2 men got out. They walked away and your neighbors called it in. I am so sorry, but before we could respond, it exploded," said the detective. The rescue team walked out of the cloud of steam and smoke with a stretcher with a white body bag partially zipped closed. A single arm was hanging out of the bag, with the simple ring he had purchased so long ago on the only complete finger on its hand. "I am truly sorry for your loss. Do you know who could do this?" The stretcher was met by a tall man wearing a blue jacket with the word coroner in white letters on the back. He gently moved the arm back into the bag and zipped it closed. "No," he said as his wits slowly came back to him. "I have no enemies. I don't know anyone. He could feel familiar ice in his veins now. There was no business here for the police. He knew she was gone. They had a great life together, and now she was at peace. He, however, was at war.